It is Monday, November 12th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The Circle of Life Hospice presents its 12th annual gala, Voyage to a Dream, Saturday, beginning at 6:30 p.m. This fundraiser will be held at the John Q. Hammond Center in Rogers and will feature dinner, dancing, auctions, and more. Tickets and information available at voyageforhospice.com. KUAF is supported by Soul Yoga Lounge, located on Dixon Street in front of Clubhouse Fitness in Fayetteville. Hot yoga is available to the community each Friday afternoon at 5:45. All skill levels are welcome. SoulYogaLounge.com for more information. Ahead on this Monday edition of Ozarks, the search for quartz sand in northern Arkansas, a process important for natural gas drilling. Plus, 1 year and a day after opening, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art has welcomed nearly 600,000 visitors. And research at the University of Arkansas offers some insight into what's happening during oral arguments at the United States Supreme Court. First, final modifications are being made to Governor Mike Beebe's budget for the coming fiscal year, which will be presented to lawmakers later this week. The $4.7 billion plan is expected to keep spending flat, with efforts to address an expected Medicaid shortfall. Republicans, who are in the majority in the legislature for the first time in over a century, are expected to push for income tax cuts. But the governor's spokesman, Matt DeCampbell, says their victories at the polls last week haven't changed the governor's priorities.
His biggest priority for any tax relief is going to remain the sales tax on groceries, trying to get that eliminated the rest of the way. He has some ideas about how to do that, and those will be presented next Thursday as well. And we just continue toward the same goal at the end of the day that we know that the legislature has as well, regardless of who's in power, and that's to make sure that we have a balanced budget, that we're taking the best care of the taxpayers' money as we can while still providing the services that they need.
The formal presentation of the governor's plan will be before the Joint Budget Committee of the legislature. Modern gun deer season opened throughout the state Saturday morning, and more than a quarter million people were expected to hunt over the weekend. Steve Wilson with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission says he expects over 200,000 deer to be harvested this season, just a fraction of the state's deer population. Wilson says there is plenty of food for the deer this year, especially in southern Arkansas, thanks in part to beneficial rains brought by Hurricane Isaac. You can find out more information about deer season at agfc.com. Thursday is America's Recycle Day, and events will be held through the week in Fayetteville in conjunction with the nationally recognized Recycling Day. Several events will be held at Ozark Natural Foods. Lisa Garrett is the store's owner services coordinator.
Wednesday between 4:30 and 6, we're having a rain barrel workshop, where people can come in and pay $15 and they get all the supplies to make a rain barrel and take that home with them. And for every $15 spent, ONF is going to match and donate that money to Fayetteville Watershed Partnership. And then Thursday, we're doing a drive-through recycling from noon to 6, and we're having volunteers from the U of A Office of Sustainability come help us out with that. And basically, cars can just drive up, and we'll take the recycling out of their vehicle for them and dispose of it in our recycling area in the parking lot.
On Friday, Ozark Natural Foods will host a number of other companies in the city of Fayetteville to educate customers about sustainability efforts, and a truck from the Habitat for Humanity Restore will be on hand to accept donations of used or unwanted building materials. Saturday morning from 10 until noon, Lisa Garrett will offer a crafts workshop where all the crafts will be made from recycled goods. She says that ONF decided to host the events to help raise awareness of recycling programs available in the city of Fayetteville.
We started our own center out in the parking lot to help our owners. Originally, it was because we were trying to figure out ways to recycle more, such as all the plastics and stuff that we're now able to recycle through the city as kind of a pilot program. And then, you know, we also take batteries for people. And really, I think the main reason we do all of this is because a lot of people don't know that they can, you know, recycle their batteries and that they don't have to drive all the way to Happy Hollow to do their recycling. They can do it right here.
The recycling center at ONF accepts plastics, mixed paper, and cardboard. Even without glass recycling, Garrett says the city has to come twice a week to empty the drop-off containers to keep them from overflowing. Drivers in Fort Smith should be aware of lane closures to Interstate 540. Beginning tomorrow, southbound lanes of the interstate will be closed between Old Greenwood Road and Zero Street. According to a press release from the Arkansas State Highway and Transportation Department, either the left or right lane will be closed daily from 8:30 until 3 through Friday. Closures are reportedly necessary for crews to repair the driving surface of bridges along that stretch of the interstate. The Razorback volleyball team defeated Kentucky yesterday in a hard-fought five-set victory at Barnhill Arena. It improves Arkansas's overall record to 19-8, and the Razorbacks are 10-6 in SEC play. The team will return to Barnhill this weekend for a pair of Southeastern Conference matches against Georgia and Mississippi. The Arkansas women's cross-country team had a stellar finish Friday in the NCAA Division I South Central Regional Championships. The team finished the regional meet at Agri Park in Fayetteville in first place, securing the team spot in the NCAA Championships and marking the second straight regional title and 17th in team history. But victory was felt on the men's side of the cross-country ledger as well. The 10th ranked men's cross-country team finished runner-up in the men's Division I Regional Championships in Fayetteville. Second place finish marks the 42nd time the men's team has made it to the NCAA Championships. The collegiate cross-country season closes Saturday with the Division I Championships at Tom Sawyer State Park in Louisville, Kentucky. Clear and cold tonight, lows in the lower to mid-20s in northwest Arkansas, lows in the mid-30s tonight in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, clear in the morning, then partly cloudy in the afternoon with highs in the mid to upper 50s. And for Tuesday night, clear with lows from the upper 20s to lower 30s. This is Ozarks at Large. Mountaintop removal or strip mining for coal is common in places like Appalachia and Arizona. But strip mining is also occurring to some degree on the north central Ozarks, not for coal, but for thick deposits of quartz sand, a process that's critical to natural gas drilling. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
Under a microscope, beach sand looks like a pile of river pebbles, all different shapes and colors. But frac sand, so-called, is different. The clear quartz particles are uniform size, rounded, and crush-resistant, perfect for unconventional natural gas drilling. The sand mixed with millions of gallons of water and tons of chemicals are injected deep underground to hydrofracture or frac horizontal shale formations, filled with trapped methane gas. And there's a motherload of silica sand beneath western Izard County.
If you cut the top off of a mountain or cut the side out of a hill, you leave a huge scar on the ecosystem.
Gerald Weber, a retired aerospace engineer with Lockheed Martin in California, operates Country Oaks Bed and Breakfast on 70 acres of land in Mountain View in Stone County. He also serves on the board of Friends of North Fork and White Rivers.
This is the Ozark region and extends into the what's also called the Boston Mountain region, but it's eroded plain, which is eroded over thousands of years, and we have lots of springs and lots of streams.
And sand, lots of sand just beneath the forest, critical to Arkansas's natural gas industry. Companies like Chesapeake, XTO, and Southwestern Energy have drilled more than 4,000 gas wells just to the south on Claiborne, Conway, Faulkner, and Searcy counties, investing nearly $12.8 billion since 2008. Unlike construction sand, which averages around $10 per ton, this silica is pricey stuff, $60 per ton. So mining companies have opened new quarries to harvest frac sand around the state, and especially on Izard County.
The locals are, of course, are behind the jobs because it creates good jobs for them there. And, of course, the trucking, they have to haul the sand, you know, to different places, to the wells and stuff. So that has created jobs as well. But many of the local citizens are also concerned about the potential damage.
Weber and his group worry about all the water being used to wash and process freshly mined sand. Todd Fugit, geology supervisor with the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission, has been trying to measure water use by frac sand miners. ARNC is the state's water resource planning and management agency. He described the geology of the St. Peter and Calico Rock Formation on the Salem Plateau in the region as very silica rich.
And this plateau area of north central Arkansas in the Ozark Mountains has this formation at the surface, so it's very quick and easy to have access to mining of this sand.
and so is the water supply on this karst terrain. There's lots of water.
Yes, it's a karst terrain. Karst is a terrain that's found where you have calcium carbonate type formations, such as, you know, limestones and dolomites. And that karst terrain can have things, features like sinkholes, and it can have disappearing streams, things like that. And it's important to know when you're in a karst terrain, because you have a very rapid exchange of surface water to groundwater. And so it's extremely vulnerable to land surface activities.
2 years ago, Todd Fugit and his colleague Jay Johnston conducted a hydrological evaluation of frac sand mining on the Ozark Aquifer, which underlies much of north central Arkansas. The preliminary report shows that just one mine was using 743,000 gallons of fresh water per day. And if more mines drill water wells, that could adversely impact public water supply wells over a large area, the report concludes.
We do recommend that if we at some point see that there could be 5 to 10 or 20 or more wells used in this area as part of the sand mining, at that point, we would want to do some groundwater flow modeling, and we've built that capacity, that tool, with the U.S. Geological Survey, Arkansas District. They're located here in Little Rock. We work closely with them, and we would want to do some real groundwater flow modeling to determine the long-term impacts.
While groundwater supplies are not regulated by any state agency, Todd Fugit says, the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality monitors frac sand mining surface water use and discharge. Spokesperson Catherine Beninati.
We have 21 sites permitted to mine frac sand around the state. Of those, 3 are in Izard County, and of those 3, 2 are quarries.
The State Pollution Control and Ecology Commission's Regulation 15, the Arkansas Open Cut Mining and Land Reclamation Code, provide non-coal mining operation standards for both operations and reclamation.
They have to have a detailed mining plan, and not only that, but a detailed reclamation plan, so that we know exactly how the property will be restored and used in the future. And then if a property is more than 40 acres in size or 40 acres or larger, then the company also has to work with a registered engineer to prepare a site map. There's other things that they have to provide too: financial insurance, maps, proof that they have the right to mine on the property, and a disclosure statement. And then all of that goes through a public notice period.
Companies must also secure NPDES, or National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, and necessary air quality permits to manage dust emissions.
Any of that wastewater would need to be treated through an acceptable treatment system, either mechanical, which would be gravity fed, or chemical, or a combination of the two, and that would be determined through that process, that application process.
Since frac sand mining started up in 2008 in Arkansas, ADEQ has issued 3 legal consent administrative orders. Those are pollution citations. The first was against Specialty Sands for illegally mining frac sand out of the White River near Batesville. And last year, Bluebird Sand Company, based in Mount Pleasant in Izard County, was cited for operating without air and water permits and fouling a tributary to the White River with sediments.
The Bluebird penalty was $125,000. And as, like I said, as far as we know, the business isn't currently in operation, but we are continuing to monitor that site and will pursue appropriate action if necessary. There was one other CAO, and that was DeSoto Sand of North Little Rock, and they paid $5,100. Essentially, they were engaging in sand washing without obtaining a stormwater permit.
Which is significant because the multi-million-dollar DeSoto mine is owned by Southwestern Energy, a top natural gas producer on the Fayetteville Shale. Bluebird Sand, currently offline, declined comment for this report. But Andrew Bradley, spokesperson for Uniman, the largest frac sand mining operation in the state, did via email. He said Uniman's 500-acre sand mine near the town of Guyon produces 1 million tons per year. With a staff of 22 and 86 hourly laborers, it operates 24/7. The company diverts surface water from a tributary of the White River to wash and process sand and recycles a fifth of its water. It owns and leases nearly 3,000 acres of land in Izard County, so has room for expansion. Uniman, based in New Canaan, Connecticut, one of North America's leading producers of non-metallic industrial minerals, also has operations in western Wisconsin, a major frac sand producing state. And finally, Evergreen Processing, based in Shreveport, Louisiana, was permitted in 2009 to mine Twin Mountain Quarry near Calico Rock. But ADEQ's Catherine Beninati says it's currently not in operation, according to their inspectors.
We have inspectors around the state, and every complaint is investigated as soon as possible. Our mining staff and our water staffs work together. We have one inspector in the mining division and 20 positioned around the state in the water division. And so we respond to complaints with those divisions working together as expeditiously as possible and do as many inspections as possible.
During the shale boom, agencies like ADEQ and the Arkansas Oil and Gas Commission scrambled to meet an avalanche of compliance reviews and field inspections. Both agencies will ask the state legislature in 2013 to approve the addition of more inspectors. And environmental advocates like Jerry Weber says increased monitoring is critical.
So it's not just water issues that surround the frack industry. You know, it's there are these other issues as well. And so it's a big thing for Arkansas because we have a very pristine area in the country, and many people move here or have lived here all their lives want to keep it that way, you know.
With an overabundance of natural gas on the market, fracking operations have diminished on the Fayetteville Shale. But a second Obama administration looking at granting natural gas export licenses will eventually re-stimulate and expand the fracking industry in Arkansas in coming years, including frack sand mining. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The election, of course, dominated the news in Arkansas last week, but as Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business points out, there was other news worth noting from the past 7 days.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political stories of the last week. The Arkansas Farm Bureau's 27th annual Thanksgiving dinner survey shows that families will only pay 1 cent more on average for their traditional Turkey Day meal. According to the survey, it will cost $45.12 for a family of 10 to have a Thanksgiving dinner. That's about $4.50 per person. Last year's average was $45.11. Now, the shopping list for this survey has remained unchanged since 1986 to allow for some consistent price comparisons. Items on the list include turkey, milk, sweet potatoes, rolls, cranberries, coffee, pumpkin pie mix, whipped cream, stuffing, green peas, celery, and carrots. Centennial Bank, a wholly owned subsidiary of Home BancShares out of Conway, announced it's acquired all the deposits and most of the assets of Heritage Bank of Florida, with offices located in Tampa Bay and the surrounding area. That's through an agreement with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It's the eighth bank that Home BancShares has purchased in Florida in the past 4 years. Dillard's reported higher revenue but substantially lower profits as the Little Rock-based mall retailer exited its third quarter. The company disclosed third quarter revenues topped $1.48 billion, net income of $48.5 million. Rising business service revenue and increases in consumer broadband products drove Windstream Corporation's third quarter revenues to higher ground. The Little Rock-based communications company posted sales and revenue of more than $1.55 billion for the quarter, and that's up substantially from a little over $1 billion 1 year ago. But profits were lower, in part due to $12 million in restructuring charges, as Windstream alters its workforce to accommodate its changing business model from a rural telecom to a broadband and infrastructure company. Net income fell from $78 million 1 year ago to $53.7 million in the current quarter. AT&T announced plans to invest $14 billion over the next 3 years nationwide, and Arkansas leaders say the state will benefit. AT&T's announcement comes as hypergrowth in wireless and mobile devices has placed stress on telecommunications companies' infrastructure. The company did not disclose state-by-state investment under the new investment program, but AT&T typically announces its annual capital expenditures around year's end. And Arkansas voters approved a temporary half-cent sales tax for highways while rejecting proposals to allow for medical marijuana and to give cities and counties more financing tools. Issue number one allows for a 10-year temporary half-cent sales tax increase for four-lane highway construction and repairs. It passed with 58% to 42% support. Issue number 5, the medical marijuana initiative stirred the most passion among voters this election cycle. The proposal, which was defeated narrowly by a 51-49% margin, would have allowed for up to 30 nonprofit dispensaries in Arkansas. Supporters of the medical marijuana measure say they will be back in 2 years. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
This is Ozarks at Large. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville has become such a part of the Northwest Arkansas community, thanks to outdoor trails, special events, and, of course, the art collection, that it seems difficult to believe it's only been open for a year and a day. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda takes a look back at the museum's last 12 months and has this report.
Good morning, everyone. I'm afraid I represent the end of the Magnificent Voices, so I'm a little lonely up here. We thank you all for being here on this very special day. Crystal Bridges looks forward to celebrating many of our uniquely American holidays and traditions in the future. When determining the date for the museum's public opening, we believed it was fitting to be a part of this Veterans Day and offer our support and recognition to the men and women who have served our country throughout.
On November 11th, 2011, a celebration on the downtown Bentonville Square not only celebrated Veterans Day, it also marked the official grand opening of Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art to the public. Don Bacigalupi, the museum's executive director, was one of several speakers and musical performers who entertained the crowd prior to the museum opening its doors to its first ticketed guests. Since that time, hundreds of thousands of visitors from all over the world have come to Crystal Bridges. Catherine Roberts, Director of Member and Guest Services, says while they had an idea of who would be coming to the museum, she thinks they underestimated a few things.
We did think through carefully the number of people who might visit, and we made estimates based on what has happened to other museums around the country when they open. But I do think we underestimated the level of enthusiasm and support that the local and regional community would have for Crystal Bridges. And for instance, when we launched our membership program, we felt that if we had 3,000 members after a 6-month period, that we would be doing great. But in actuality, we had 3,000 members join in 6 days. And that happened in July of 2011 when we launched the membership program. So that was a leading indicator, if you will, that everything we did at Crystal Bridges was probably going to be received and exciting more people and causing more people to visit and participate than we had expected. So we thought in the first year we might have a couple hundred thousand people visit, 250,000 people visit. In this year alone, we've had about 500,000 people in the year 2012 alone. So everything that we've done while we've projected and analyzed has been bigger and grander because people are so excited to come to Crystal Bridges.
From November 9th, 2011 to November 6th of this year, Roberts reports 595,223 visitors have walked through the doors at the museum, and they have come from around the country.
The top 6 states for membership, of course, include the touch states, but also include New York and California. That was a surprise. I think part of that is because there are many people in New York and California who might be serious art collectors who really are paying attention to the art scene, and so they're keyed into Crystal Bridges for that reason. With regard to our attendance in general, the people who come through the front door, about half of them, slightly over half, come from Arkansas. Then we have about 20% coming from the touch states, but actually almost 14% of our visitors come from other states beyond the touch states. So that could be Florida, New York, Oklahoma, California, Nevada, anywhere. And then actually almost 1% are international visitors. So the reach that we have has been a very exciting development to see. We thought we would have some national, international reach, but this is really a bit more than we thought.
The members Roberts is talking about are people who pay an annual fee and receive benefits like discounted admission to select exhibitions, invitations to member-only exhibition preview events, and a discount in the museum store.
Having a membership program enables us to offer special access, benefits, and privileges to people that bring them closer to the fold, that bring them, give them the inside story of the museum, and that in turn enriches their experience. You know, museums can sometimes be intimidating places, and a membership program is designed to eliminate that perception because it gives people many, many ways to access the museum, whether you're a young professional or an art collector, a way to embrace the art that we have, the activities and events, and to also show your support for the institution proudly by saying, yes, I'm a member. I'm supporting this greatest thing in Northwest Arkansas, and I'm proud to be a member.
Robert says they are able to keep track of several of these statistics by interacting with guests as soon as they walk through the door. When a visitor walks in, they are immediately directed to the front desk where they are asked if they are a member, how many people are in their party, and what their zip code is. Roberts explains the museum has software that allows them to periodically run massive reports on the data they've collected. Robert says Saturdays and Sundays tend to be the museum's busiest days in terms of attendance, followed by Wednesdays and Fridays, days when Crystal Bridges is open until 9 o'clock. She says Mondays tend to be the slowest days, and on a daily basis, there tends to be a surge of guests between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m., and things usually die down around mid-afternoon. When the museum is open later on Wednesdays and Fridays, there is another surge of visitors around 6. Roberts has been with Crystal Bridges since January of 2011 and says she thinks things have gone great so far.
This is a situation where all of us were working hard in a fun way to make this creation the best that it could be using all the information and knowledge and experience that we had. And so everybody did their best to make things great. And maybe, sure, there might be things that we would have changed now that we have the experience of opening things. Maybe I would have trained my staff earlier or changed a configuration of this, that, or the other. But we opened a terrific museum. People are showing us how much they love to come to the museum and be a part of it. So from my perspective, I think it's really been a win-win. And what we look forward to in the future is to listen more to what our members and guests want, to understand what they're looking for in a museum, and then to be able to deliver that. Because as you know, when you open a museum, you're kind of predicting and guessing at who you think will come, what their expectations are, and the type of programming that they desire. But now that we really have real people coming through the door, we can get their feedback, we can review attendance at all types of events and tweak what we're offering from there. So I think in general, the public can just look forward to more exciting programs and a wider range of activities.
More information is available at crystalbridges.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Ahead on Ozarks, oral arguments at the United States Supreme Court could be giving us some insight into what the nine justices are thinking. Research at the University of Arkansas has been published in The Forum, a journal of applied research in contemporary politics, and we'll hear from the authors in just a moment on Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. One of the most important but least witnessed procedural events in this country is an oral argument in front of the United States Supreme Court. While audio recordings of the arguments are made, video recordings are not allowed. Research at the University of Arkansas reveals a bit more about the oral argument process. Two members of the political science faculty, Patrick Stewart and Bill Schreckheis, joined then Honors College undergraduate student Chris Kimmel in an examination of the oral arguments of 11 controversial cases. Chris Kimmel says conventional wisdom is that the arguments are exercises in which lawyers try to convince justices who have come to the bench with open minds to their side of an issue. But he says research suggests something else is happening.
Oftentimes the justices come into the arguments already having made up their mind largely, and use the interruptions and the questions that they ask to try to own the conversation and to try to push the argument one way or another and to try to convince the other justices to come down on their side. And we found that basically almost most all the time across every single justice, they interrupted more times in the case that they were, or during the argument of the side they were going to rule against. They wound up interrupting more times and using a lot more statements. They didn't ask as many questions to probe for answers. They just gave statements of what they thought. During the 11 cases that we studied, for instance, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Sotomayor, every single case, they interrupted more times during the argument of the side that they wound up ruling against.
It's really interesting. And so it didn't matter ideologically what direction justices were coming from if they were more likely to interrupt on something they're against, whether they were coming from what we would consider the left or the right.
Yeah, Antonin Scalia interrupted a lot. He's sort of known as sort of like the great interrupter, but and he's definitely identified as somebody who is, you know, on one of the ideological poles of the court on the conservative side. And we found that his the difference between who he interrupted, you know, whether it was the side that he wound up voting for or against, wasn't that great. But then other justices that were far less ideological, you didn't see that happening. In fact, I ran some additional analyses that weren't included in the paper and just could not find any relationship at all, which is surprising.
There's a diagram breaking it down, and it looks like the justice who is most likely to interrupt when disagreeing is Chief Justice Roberts. The ratio between interruption for agreeing and disagreeing is vast. This is interesting because it's very few people who know what the conversation is behind the closed doors. The nine justices, maybe some clerks, I don't know. But this guy gives us some insight a little bit to the thinking process that we wouldn't otherwise have.
I think you're exactly right. Yeah, in fact, when it comes to the conferences, nobody is allowed into that room except for the justices themselves.
Just the nine.
So we know very little of what goes on. We know a little bit about what goes on after that because we have access to some of the former justices' papers, and we can see drafts of opinion, and we can see them writing things like take this out, or I'll write a dissent, or we need to clear this up, or whatever. But I think this is a pretty clear indication of what the process is more broadly, because it shows that, yeah, it looks like a lot of the justices come to the bench with their minds made up. Maybe what happens during oral arguments could possibly sway a justice here and there who just really has no idea. But at the end of the day, it doesn't seem to make that much of a difference. And what could make a lot more difference is what happens after that as well.
I guess you went through transcripts. There are recordings of the arguments in front of the bench. You listened and read. Is that part of the research?
We went through, through 11 different cases, and because there's obviously no video recording allowed in the court itself, so we listened to the audio recording and followed along with the transcript to pick through it all.
Yeah, and following on that, if we were able to do more of have the video recording, that would tell us an awful lot more. I'm more of a guy that looks at the nonverbals as far as the body language, facial displays and the like there. And so that would give us even more insight as to what's going on. As it stands, the only way you can get that is if you go to the Supreme Court and actually watch them in action. But you can't videotape them. They don't allow that. And that's been a big problem and a big issue.
I'm wondering if attorneys or journalists who cover the court could use this information to kind of make, I mean, again, you know, justices' past histories with decisions, and you can, you know, a lot of people who don't cover the Supreme Court can kind of make guesses, though you do get surprises. But I'm wondering if journalists who cover it or lawyers can get a better gauge of where this decision is going to be a few months from now after the oral arguments.
That's our hope, is that the, you know, the individuals who are watching, the court watchers, the serious court watchers, will be able to open that black box a little bit more. It's the most elite of institutions by design, and it's become even more elite by the nature of the individuals who end up on the court itself. So opening it up for the rest of America, which has become extremely diverse, to this very elite and it's educationally not that diverse a body, is important for me at least.
Yeah, I would also add, too, from a litigant's perspective, from an attorney's perspective, I think a lot of times what the public doesn't know, and perhaps even attorneys who wind up practicing before the court don't know, is how frequently the interruptions are. And I've often told my students when I talk about oral arguments, when you listen to oral arguments, when you come as an attorney, you have this beautiful, well-crafted, well-laid-out argument, and you open your mouth and you get maybe two sentences out, and then boom, you ask a question. Then you ask another question. And one of the things that really surprised me was when we actually tabulated them after Chris counted them all, that the average number of interruptions per side per case was about 140 interruptions, which is a lot, which means if you are an attorney practicing, you are going to be spending a lot of time having to answer questions or deal with the interruption if it's a statement. And from an attorney's perspective, there might be some interruptions that are worth more than others. If you have somebody that you're pretty sure isn't going to vote with you, or if you're pretty sure is going to vote with you, answer the question and move on. If there's somebody in the middle, then you might want to spend a little more time trying to drive that point home.
You probably had to complete this research before the Affordable Care Act was argued. It would be interesting now, because that was kind of a surprise to many, it'd be interesting to go back and see if Justice Roberts interrupted often or not as often, given that he tends to interrupt more often when he's against something.
Oh, yes, indeed. And that's certainly something that can be looked at. And you know, maybe Chris will look at that. Maybe there's a honor student out there that we can convince to do the analysis and go a little bit more fine-honed in their analysis there, because there's not just the interruptions, but also the other parapsychological sort of things or that might tell us more information about what's going on.
I can't imagine how intimidating it is just to be arguing in front of the Supreme Court, especially if it's your first time, let alone be 5 or 10 seconds into an argument or a response only to be interrupted. That's got to be one of the most intimidating things that can happen.
Well, the architecture of the Supreme Court is designed in such a way is to intimidate anybody who walks in there. It's modeled after the Temple of Delphi in Greece. And in Temple of Delphi, you go to ask the great god the question, and you'd be given an answer. It's just so litigants, when they go before the court, are asking the great gods to rule in their favor, perhaps. So it's designed that way. It's designed just to be a little off-putting.
But the great gods would answer almost immediately, right? They wouldn't wait months. They would give you the answer before you left.
And it was usually unanimous, too.
Yes, yes. I'm curious, have any of the three of you seen an argument in front of the Supreme Court?
No. I've certainly been to the Supreme Court building multiple times and seen it, but it's my area of expertise goes more towards political debates, so it's not as keen for me.
It's on my to-do list. Chris, you were there last year, weren't you?
I was there about a year. This year ago, I watched a case that I can't remember the name of the case off the top of my head, but it was actually one of the lawyers that was arguing was from the Justice Department, and he was one that argued a case that I studied as well. So it's interesting to see him actually in action after I had just listened to the recording. But I saw one about a year ago.
What was it like?
It was very interesting, and you could see how intimidating it could be. As Bill said, the visuals are striking. When you're standing up there alone in front of 9 of the most brilliant people in the world, and they are literally judging you, and you have a lot to answer for. You have a lot of tough questions and a lot of very probing questions that they are more than willing and more than ready to ask. So it's very, it would be extremely intimidating to be standing up there.
The research for the article of Closed Minds and Open Mouths, Indicators of Supreme Court Justice Vote During the 2009 and 2010 Sessions, was conducted by Chris Kimmel while he was an Honors College undergraduate student at the University of Arkansas, along with two members of the U of A Political Science faculty, Bill Schreckeis and Patrick Stewart. Our conversation was recorded Friday afternoon inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. You can hear more from that interview in an audio extra at our website, OzarksAtLarge.com.
You send your child off to war, and they join a new family. When they return home, how does that affect yours? I'm Jackie Leiden. From the front lines to the home front, when your child returns from war. Plus our weekly read of the opinion page. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Matt Bauer, a singer, songwriter, and banjo player, has become a critical darling. New York Magazine has called his music brilliant, and Under the Radar, another music magazine, has described his gentle compositions as fragile beauty. His latest recording was partially recorded in rural Arkansas, and Ozarks at Large's Katie Hendrickson recently talked with him.
That's a duet between Matt Bauer and Jolie Holland, and it's on the singer-songwriter and banjo player Matt Bauer's new EP, No Shape Can Hold Me Now. The five-song EP was written by Bauer in Brooklyn, San Francisco, Lexington, Kentucky, and Gilbert, Arkansas. It's a population of 28.
I was, like, looking at where you recorded your new EP, and one of those places is Gilbert, Arkansas.
Yeah. I was there for all of February. My girlfriend, who's also a musician, she's from Michigan originally, but she went to school at Hendrix. A friend whose family had this little, tiny little rental cabin in Gilbert that nobody was using because it was the winter time, and it's more of a, like, it's on the Buffalo River, and I think people go there in the summer to canoe and stuff. So in the winter, it's like the one restaurant is closed and the one store is closed, and so it was us and lots of animals. I did part of the little bit of the recording there, and actually a lot of writing for my next record there.
Describe this cabin where you're writing a lot.
We had no internet, which was really awesome. You can't. It's nice to be forced to ignore all of that stuff and be left with, what can I do? Oh, I should actually play my banjo because I'm supposed to be a musician. I should do that instead of checking my email yet again. So that was nice. And it was just up the hill from a bend in the Buffalo River. And I don't know, we would just go on hikes all over the area. There are actually hundreds and hundreds of vultures that would all nest together at this place, on these set of, like, just a few trees on the bank of the river near the cabin. And like in the evening time, you would see them start to come in from different directions. So I don't know. So it was us and no internet and a million vultures.
No Shape Can Hold Me Now follows up 2008's The Island Moved in the Storm, a full-length release from Matt Bauer. And it is the same sort of style, so that means it's intricate indie folk melancholy. The short and graceful and cyclical closing track, Homeward Bound, is particularly moving.
Oh, close your eyes and go to sleep. And when you wake, you'll wait to be with all the dreams you thought were torn down. And close your eyes, we're homeward bound. The window's down.
I grew up in Kentucky when I was little, in eastern Kentucky, and then when I was a little older in central Kentucky. And it's supposed to be about that, about... I feel like my songs are always have like three or four different things that don't necessarily make sense linearly together, but sort of come together. I guess it's supposed to be about coming back home to central Kentucky. And I was thinking in particular this, not a long time ago now, but I was riding in the passenger seat with my
brother driving. We're coming home from North Carolina, coming back to Kentucky, and I don't know, just sort of that feeling of coming back home and it's the end of the day and the window's down, and I don't know, feels somehow like coming home from the lake at the end of the day or something. I can't think of something that's not like some new agey thing, like a safe place. But like, I don't know, just coming home to somewhere and at least just having a brief moment where whatever, you know, worries that you have in the world are sort of put aside and you're in this familiar place. So I don't know, I think that's kind of what I was trying to get at. This is why I write songs, because my explanation is like longer than the song.
Matt Bauer's new EP, No Shape Can Hold Me Now, is out right now on Crossbill Records. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
This is Ozarks at Large, and a recommendation for what to do with your evening hours tonight. Michelle Boisseau, a poet who has been published several times by the University of Arkansas Press, will be on the University of Arkansas campus tonight. She'll have a reading beginning at 7 at Giffels Auditorium inside Old Main on the U of A campus. It was just under a year ago that Garrison Keillor read one of her poems, At My Brother's Place, as part of Writer's Almanac.
The TV set whose picture works rides on top the TV whose sound does. The stations change with the needle-nosed pliers. From the bed where he lies most of the day, draggle sheets flecked with holes where his ashes have dropped. Every surface is covered with the fuzz of ash, punctuated by twisted cigarette packs. His teeth hurt him to wear. From a chair seat, they grin at a crowd of Coke cans. Here's the Bible he chants from at night. His third this month, they have a way of disappearing, like the $50 bill I gave him yesterday. I've brought him salami and cherries, pumpernickel and mustard, a plastic knife to spread it with. And look, new T-shirts, new socks, a roll of stamps and paper, a phone card, an address book, where I've written all our numbers. When I've unloaded the packages, and he has eaten everything at once, breathing hard, spitting cherry pits into his fist, I walk out to my rental car, clean and empty.
The poem At My Brother's Place by Michelle Boisseau, read by Garrison Keillor as part of a December 2012 edition of Writer's Almanac. Michelle Boisseau will read tonight inside Giffels Auditorium in Old Main on the University of Arkansas campus. It begins at 7. It is free and open to the public. The poem At My Brother's Place is from Trembling Air, published by the University of Arkansas Press. And speaking of Writer's Almanac, here's today's edition.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 12th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of DeWitt Wallace, St. Paul, Minnesota, 1889. His father taught Greek and Old English at McAllister College. But the son rebelled against him. He became a businessman instead, worked for a publishing house that specialized in agricultural textbooks, enlisted in the Army for World War I, was seriously wounded. During his recovery, he read hundreds of magazines and realized that a pocket-sized magazine full of condensed general interest articles from other magazines could be a hit. And with that idea, he compiled a sample issue of the first Reader's Digest. First issue came out February 1922, and by the end of the decade, Reader's Digest went on to become the most successful magazine of all time. And it was on this day in 1954, Ellis Island formally closed its doors. It had processed more than 12 million immigrants to the United States in more than a half century of service. The first and second class passengers who arrived in this country, they did not go to Ellis Island. They were given just a brief inspection on board, check for any obvious disease. It was the poorer third-class and steerage passengers who were ferried to the island. And immigration officials observed them as they climbed the staircase into the main hall. They put a little chalk on the coats of those they thought might be sick. But if you were in good health and your story checked out, processing might take only about 5 hours. In 1907, more than 1 million people passed through Ellis Island. But then, around the time of World War I, immigration from Europe began to slow down. Ellis Island was made into a detention center for suspected enemies, and it was closed on this day in 1954. Ellis Island sat abandoned for 30 years, and in 1984 they began restoration. Almost 40% of Americans can trace their ancestry through the gates of Ellis Island. Here's a poem for today by Joan I. Siegel, entitled Night School for My Grandmother. In a classroom like this one, where her children once sat fidgeting for the bell to ring so they could grab their jackets and shout to the cold air and sun shining on Broadway, 2 blocks from home, where 2 flights up she had set out bread and milk on the kitchen table because she was down the street at the tailor's shop, turning a shirt collar or mending a man's coat, and nights she got down on her hands and knees to wash floors in an office building on 2nd Avenue, things she had learned as a girl in Poland and brought with her, a boat ride away to Ellis Island, to the man she married, and soon enough their 4 children, 1 dead, and after he died of influenza, to the new husband and his 5 children, 1 dead, and in time to the new daughters-in-law and sons-in-law in their uptown apartments and the babies, 1 at a time. She sat practicing her Palmer letters, connecting the fine threads of ink, each graceful curve looping to the next, like crocheting a pair of ladies' gloves, making words where silence used to be. Night School, a poem by Joan I. Siegel, from her collection Hyacinth for the Soul, published by Deerbrook Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Goddard College, offering low residency bachelor's and master's of fine arts degrees in creative writing. More at goddard.edu. And by reputation.com, helping businesses leverage a powerful form of advertising, online reviews. Learn more at reputation.com. Written by Joy Biles, produced by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Clarksville. The Village Players in Bella Vista will present The Philadelphia Story November 16th, 17th, and 18th at the Northwest Arkansas Community College's White Auditorium. You can enjoy The Village Players' adaptation of the 1939 comic play by Philip Barry. If you're interested in tickets or more information, 876-1418. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Antoinette Grajeda will join me tomorrow for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks so much for listening.